I want you to try and picture something with me for a second. Imagine you were standing in the Vatican archives.
Oh, wow. Okay. Setting the scene.
Right. So you are looking down this seemingly endless corridor of historical documents. And if you were to walk past every single shelf in that archive, you'd literally be walking for 85 linear kilometers.
Which is just, I mean, it's staggering. It's essentially a marathon and then another full marathon, just entirely past centuries of human record.
Yeah, exactly. You've got birth certificates, marriage licenses, ecclesiastical decrees, all just sitting there in physical space.
And, the physical scale alone is mind-bending. But then when you cross the ocean and look at the U.S. National Archives, you're confronted with over 13 billion pages of records.
13 billion. That's just, it's hard to even wrap your head around.
Right. And then you add in the microfilm vaults of various global organizations holding documents from, over 100 different countries, and you just hit a wall. When you step back and look at the sheer, overwhelming mass of humanity's historical footprint, you realize pretty quickly that no single human being can process even a tiny fraction of a percent of it.
No, absolutely not. And not even a massive, well-funded organization could do it. I think we often assume modern technology is sort of the magic bullet here, right? Like, oh, we can just unleash a supercomputer on the archives.
Yeah, people think AI will just magically read it all.
Exactly. But no single AI model can read all of that, parse it, and actually make sense of it either. The work of genealogical research, like the actual work of piecing together human history, is what systems engineers call irreducibly distributed.
Which is a great phrase. And that phrase is really the key to understanding the modern challenge of historical research.
Irreducibly distributed.
Right. It basically means work will always, by definition, require millions of independent minds and machines working in parallel. So you'll have a historian in Germany looking at a parish registry, while an AI in California is indexing an 1850 census, while a volunteer in Ireland translates a headstone.
So they are working on completely different parts of the archive.
Exactly. Different archives, different languages, and this whole process will unfold over decades.
Which brings us to the core of today's deep dive. If we have this incredibly fragmented, globally distributed workforce of humans and AI all trying to piece together the same massive historical puzzle, how on earth do they actually coordinate?
It's the million-dollar question.
Right. So we are doing a deep dive into a system designed to solve that exact problem. It is called the Max Task Schema, and it basically acts as the underlying blueprint for coordinating all this distributed research.
Yeah, it's a fascinating framework.
So let's imagine we are all trying to build a massive global cathedral. Millions of people, and now millions of AI bots, are constantly showing up to the construction site carrying stones. In our case, the stones are dataso, passenger lists, census records, baptismal fonts.
I love this analogy.
Thanks. But if we don't have a rigid system in place, people are going to bring stones that don't fit the arches. Or, worse, they are going to bring stones made of styrofoam painted to look like rock, and the whole cathedral just eventually collapses.
And that challenge is entirely about how we inspect and place those stones. So, to do that, the architects of this schema had to move from the overwhelming scale of those 85 kilometers of shelves down to the absolute smallest, most manageable unit of work.
Right, getting really granular.
Exactly. And in this system, that unit is called a task. A max task is essentially the foundational building block of the entire schema.
But looking at the documentation for this, a task isn't just some general request, right? Like, I can't just submit a bounty to the network that says, hey, please find my great grandfather. He lived in Chicago.
No, that is way too vague for a distributed system to handle. Vague requests break distributed systems. A max task has to be hyper-specific so that a machine or a human knows exactly what the finish line looks like.
So give us an example of how that actually looks in practice.
Sure. The source material highlights this with a classic genealogical headache. A proper task is phrased more like, verify whether the Johann Mueller in record X is the same person as the John Miller in record Y.
Oh, man. Anyone who has ever looked at 19th century immigration records just felt a shiver down their spine at that example.
Yeah, it's notoriously difficult.
Because you have these German immigrants arriving in New York, and the port official basically just writes down what they hear phonetically. So Johann becomes John, Mueller becomes Miller.
Exactly. And the sources mention other classic examples, too. You have a family name like Makeswell that morphs into Maxwell over just a single generation, or a traditional Irish name like O'Brien gets anglicized into O'Brien.
Right. And for a human, parsing those variations requires understanding context, handwriting, maybe even historical literacy rates.
And for an AI, it requires really complex probabilistic matching. The max task schema basically isolates that specific question. Are these two records pointing to the exact same biological human being? And turns it into a discrete, assignable unit of work.
And once it's a discrete unit, the schema can route it. So a task like that Miller and Miller verification could be sent to an AI agent or a human volunteer or maybe even a specialized research firm.
Yep, it's completely agnostic about who does the work.
But what really caught my eye in the architecture is the inclusion of guardrails, specifically cost caps.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge feature. Because automated research carries a very specific financial risk. If you deploy an AI agent to search through paid databases to solve a discrepancy, that agent might get caught in a logic loop.
Oh, like it just keeps searching endlessly.
Exactly. It could keep pinging an expensive API over and over, trying to find a record that literally doesn't exist. So MaxTask allows the creator of the task to embed a hard cost cap directly into the JSON payload.
So it's basically a circuit breaker.
Right. It ensures a rogue bot doesn't burn through $50 in API calls trying to solve a $5 genealogical problem.
That is so smart. And you can also set hard deadlines and establish dependencies, right? Like, you can write a rule that says task B, let's say, searching for marriage records, cannot legally begin until task A, which verifies the birth record, is successfully completed.
Yep, the dependencies are built right in, but the routing really hinges on the task types. The schema categorizes everything into 10 specific buckets.
Right, I saw those. We have things like extract to cord, which is literally just pulling the raw data out of a physical or digital source.
Mm.
Or merge person, which is that Mueller and Miller problem we just talked about, deciding if two profiles are the same individual.
There's also validate record, judge review, resolve conflict, build tree, fetch and earn archive, cost report, and a catch-all category simply labeled other.
And then there is one more, right?
Yeah, ingest to conjurant, which I have to admit, sounds like a command from a science fiction novel.
I was going to ask about that one. Because ingest.grit sounds incredibly technical compared to just, you know, build tree, what is actually happening there mechanically?
So it is basically the bridge between human history and machine learning. Qdrint is a vector database. Traditional databases search for exact keywords. Vector databases, on the other hand, turn text and concepts into mathematical coordinates.
Wait. Mathematical coordinates.
Yeah. So if an AI is looking for a record, it isn't just looking for the exact spelling of Maxwell. It is looking in the mathematical vicinity of the concept of that family. And ingest.grit task is specifically asking a worker to take a historical record, translate it into those mathematical coordinates, and store it so that future AI models can actually understand it rather than just read it.
That is wild. But, you know, the task type isn't just a filing cabinet label, though. The type dictates the entire downstream flow. It changes what data is included in the package, who is allowed to accept the work, and how the results are judged.
Absolutely. It drives the whole process.
Which brings me to a major point of skepticism I had when looking at this.
Oh, let's hear it.
Well, if I create a highly specific, bounty-like, verifying Johann Mueller, and I route it out to a massive network of anonymous volunteers and AI agents, what is the mechanical barrier preventing a bot from just handing me back a scribbled digital napkin?
A scribbled napkin.
Yeah, like what stops it from just saying, yep, they're the same guy, I checked, now pay me my bounty.
Yeah, that is arguably the most dangerous vulnerability in crowdsourced research. If a system accepts freeform text as a result, it will inevitably be flooded with absolute garbage.
Right, it would just be spam.
But the developers of MaxTask anticipated this. Our result in this schema cannot be a text blob. The concept of done is strictly defined by an array called acceptance criteria.
So the worker doesn't just see the prompt. They see a literal checklist.
Exactly. They see objective, explicitly checkable conditions. Before a worker even accepts the task, the software presents the parameters. And the system will physically reject the JSON payload of the result if those criteria are not strictly met.
I think the sources outline a scenario for verifying a birth record that illustrates this perfectly.
Yes, the birth record example is great.
So the acceptance criteria might mandate that the worker must cite the exact URL of the digital archive, the specific record ID, a verbatim transcription of the date and place fields, a calculated confidence score, and a written justification. The system is basically forcing the worker to show their math.
Without those criteria, you get wildly inconsistent data that requires hours of human cleanup. With them, the results are standardized, auditable, and easily compared by machines. But the schema actually goes a layer deeper to protect the cathedral from those styrofoam stones you mentioned earlier.
Oh, There's more than just the acceptance criteria.
Yeah, there is another array called evidence required.
Ah, this is the anti-hallucination mechanism, right?
We got it.
Because when we talk about AI hallucinating, we mean the model confabulating information. These models are essentially massive prediction engines. They are designed to guess the most plausible next word based on their training data.
Right. They're crowd pleasers.
Yeah, exactly. So if you ask a standard AI chatbot to find a 17th century birth record for Johann Müller, and the record doesn't exist, the AI's architecture desperately wants to please you. So it might just invent a perfectly formatted, highly plausible citation for a phantom document.
It will completely invent the archive name, the page number, even the registrar's signature. It's wild. But the evidence required array is designed to short-circuit that generation.
How does it do that mechanically?
Well, if a task involves searching a census database, the evidence required array mandates that the worker cannot just return the answer. They must return the exact search string they used in the external database, the timestamp of the query, and the raw data returned by that specific search.
It really reminds me of a very strict high school math teacher. Getting the right answer doesn't matter at all if you can't prove step by step exactly how you arrived at it.
That's a perfect analogy.
If the AI can't provide the literal query logs of a live search, the system just knows it hallucinated the answer from its training data, and the task completely fails.
And that explicit proof creates a verifiable trail. But once that trail is established and the math is checked, the system faces another problem.
Which is?
The next researcher who comes along, maybe 50 years from now, needs to understand what happened without reading 50 pages of raw search queries and JSON payloads.
Oh, right. Because if I'm jumping into a massive family tree, I need a summary. I need to know the state of the board at a glance.
Exactly. And the schema solves this by forcing a standardized verdict vocabulary. Every single action taken during a task, every lookup, every transcription, every verification is documented in an array of steps. And every one of those steps must conclude with a specific verdict tag.
And the designers color-coded these tags, which is incredibly helpful for visualizing the data flow.
It really is.
So a green tag is a key finding. That basically means we found the smoking gun, like the exact marriage certificate we needed. Then a BLU tag is usable. It might not be the final answer, but it's a solid lead, maybe a census record showing the family living in the right county.
Right. It advances the plot.
Yeah. And an amber tag is inconclusive. So the search returned records, but the data is mixed or contradictory, like finding two Johann Müllers born in the exact same town on the exact same day.
Which happens more often than you'd think. Mm-hmm. The GREY tags represent infra, which just denotes background infrastructure work, and deadened. Now, a deadened just means you executed a search in a specific source and found absolutely nothing.
Just a dry well.
Right. Huh. But the most critical tag for the actual advancement of research is the RRED tag, which stands for ruled out. The distinction between deadened and ruled out fundamentally changes how collaborative research operates.
This nuance is so important. I was thinking about it like this. Imagine you are looking for your misplaced house keys.
Okay, well, yeah.
A deadened verdict is you checking the kitchen table. You look and the keys aren't there. They might still be in the house. They might be in the couch cushions. You just established where they aren't.
Right.
But a ruled out verdict is you watching your dog swallow the keys. Right. They are definitively destroyed. They will never, ever be found on the kitchen table or the couch. The search is definitively over.
That's hilarious, but it's exactly right. The mathematical reality of research relies heavily on that negative space. The source document actually puts it beautifully. A disproof is information. It changes the probability landscape.
Because in traditional historical research, human beings heavily bias toward the yes. We celebrate finding the certificate. We rarely publish a paper about the 70 archives we checked where we found absolutely nothing.
Exactly. There's no glory in the null hypothesis.
But proving a definitive no, applying that red ruled out tag, prevents the next 10,000 researchers, whether they are human or AI, from wasting compute cycles and human hours chasing a ghost.
It creates a structural boundary. Knowing that a specific lineage is a genetic impossibility, or that a specific person died in childhood and therefore cannot be the ancestor in question, prunes a massive branch off the decision tree.
It's so efficient.
It really is. But, you know, all of this strict definition and standardized vocabulary raises a massive operational question.
Let me guess. Who actually gets to see this stuff?
Yep. If we are routing these highly specific, mathematically rigorous tasks out to the world, who is actually allowed to touch the data?
It's a huge issue. Genealogy deals with highly sensitive information. We aren't just talking about people who died in the 1800s. Family trees intersect with living people, minors, and private medical histories.
Right.
So there have to be ironclad gates in place before a task is routed to a third-party AI.
And the architecture addresses this through what we can call the privacy gate, which is governed by a field named contributor relegibility. Systems engineers use a concept called failing closed.
How does that work?
Imagine an electronic security door during a power outage. If it fails open, the lock disengages and anyone can walk right in. If it fails closed, the lock engages permanently, prioritizing security over convenience.
So if the schema doesn't explicitly know an entity is safe, it locks them out by default.
Exactly. The default state for any task involving living people is first party only. It fails closed. It absolutely cannot be outsourced. You cannot dispatch the task to an external volunteer network. You cannot run it through a third-party AI API like OpenAI or Anthropic, and you cannot send it to a freelance researcher.
It just stays entirely on the platform's internal servers.
Yes. Living people are researched only by the platform itself, governed by its own internal privacy compliance. And because MaxTask is a normative standard, any software developer building an application that uses this schema is structurally forced to respect that privacy boundary.
Because the code itself simply won't allow the routing.
Exactly.
That completely locks down the privacy side, which is great. But what about the quality side? Once a task involving public historical records comes back from a contributor, how do we evaluate it?
That is where the next gate comes in.
Because you mentioned earlier that the system won't accept a JSON payload if the acceptance criteria aren't met. But who actually checks if the provided URL points to a real document and not just a clever fake?
That is the quality gate, and it's handled by the review object. MaxTask dictates a process that really mirrors scientific peer review. The entity that performs the work is structurally forbidden from approving the work. The reviewed MIB field must log a completely different contributor ID.
So the person who writes the paper doesn't get to accept the paper for publication.
Precisely. The reviewer looks at the submitted evidence, follows the provided URLs, checks the search queries, and then issues a review verdict. They can accept the work, send it back for rework, or reject it entirely.
And they can leave notes, right?
Yeah. They also assign a quality score and provide notes. But the most vital part of the review object is the standardized vocabulary of rejection.
Looking at the schema, the rejection reasons explicitly include a tag for fabricated or hallucinated. That is a direct, hard-coded defense against bad AI and lazy human actors.
Absolutely. When a reviewer clicks the link provided in the evidence required array and hits a 404 error, or realizes the document exists but says something completely different than what the worker claimed, they apply that fabricated or hallucinated tag.
Yeah.
And that tag isn't just a localized warning. It creates a permanent cryptographic data trail attached to that worker's ID.
So it basically builds a public reputation score.
Exactly. The mathematical architecture of the system uses those tags to build a trust metric over time. If a specific AI agent or a human contractor consistently gets tagged with hallucination rejections, the routing algorithm will organically downrank them.
They just get shadow banned, essentially.
Pretty much. They will stop receiving important tasks, and eventually they will be starved of work entirely. The ecosystem self-cleanses by mathematically isolating bad actors.
Okay, I think I really understand the flow of the data now. I see how tasks are built, how they are protected from hallucinations, how the verdicts are color-coded, and how the gates protect privacy and quality.
It's a very elegant system.
It is. But as I read through the entirety of the MaxTask documentation, I hit a bit of a wall.
What did you find?
Well, I was looking for the mechanism that drives all of this activity, like the incentive structure. And there is a glaring absence in the code. I couldn't find a single field related to money.
Ah, yes.
There is no bounty amount, no currency type, no payment routing information at all.
That omission is entirely intentional, and honestly, it is a masterclass in standard design. MaxTask is an open standard. The golden rule of open standards, whether it's HTML for websites or SMTP for email, is that they must remain strictly neutral on business models.
Because if the schema forces a specific economic structure, you alienate massive chunks of the potential user base.
Exactly. If MaxTask required payment fields, platforms that run entirely on passionate volunteers, like many local historical societies, just couldn't use it. Their users would be confused or offended by $0 bounties.
And conversely, Professional genealogy marketplaces need complex escrow systems that a simple standard really can't handle.
Right, but there is actually a much more dangerous reason to leave money out.
Which,
if you encode global payment routing into an open source standard designed for automated digital tasks, you have essentially published a portable plug-and-play framework for global fraud.
Oh man, you would just be handing bad actors a standardized API for siphoning microtransactions.
Exactly.
A botnet could just endlessly execute low-level tasks, fabricating just enough evidence to pass automated checks and slowly drain the system's funds.
Yep. By stripping economics from the core schema, the designers neutralize that threat entirely. Payment and rewards are handled entirely outside the standard in a designated namespace called extensions.
So the extensions area is kind of like a blank canvas. Mm-hmm. If a specific company adopts MaxTask, they can use that space to plug in their own proprietary payment gateways mm-hmm. or a point system for volunteers without altering the core standard.
You nailed it.
To put it simply, MaxTask provides the exact recipe for how to cook the meal, but the individual restaurant decides what to charge the customer.
I like that. The source document actually draws a parallel to another part of their ecosystem. The separation between MaxRecord, which handles raw historical evidence, and MaxPerson, which handles human interpretation of that evidence.
Oh, right.
The philosophy of separation of concerns applies here as well. The open standard defines the architecture of the work. The proprietary product defines the economics.
You know, when we pull back from all the technical mechanics like the JSON payloads, the fail-closed privacy gates, the Qgent vector databases, and the anti-hallucination checks, the grand vision of this schema really starts to materialize.
It really does. It's ambitious.
We are essentially looking at a mechanism for truly scalable, verifiable history. Without something like MaxTask, researchers are out there carving beautiful, intricate stones, but they are just leaving them in their own backyards. The knowledge is trapped in isolated notebooks or siloed hard drives.
But with this schema in place, every researcher, whether biological or synthetic, is contributing to a shared standardized pool of findings.
Because the formatting is identical.
Exactly. The evidence is mechanically verified. The negative space of the ruled out verdicts is permanently mapped. This means the findings can be computationally compared and built upon without the next generation having to redo all the foundational work.
The end goal described in the sources feels like a massive leap forward for historical truth. We are moving toward a reality where an AI model can constantly scan a global, interconnected family tree.
And it can use mathematical probability to identify weak points, like a birth date that physically contradicts a later census record.
And without any human intervention, the system can automatically generate a hyper-specific max task to resolve the conflict.
Right. And because of the task types and the routing rules, the system knows exactly where to send it. It dispatches the task to a human specialist living near the specific archive in Bavaria, or it routes it to a specialized AI model trained exclusively on reading 17th century Cyrillic handwriting.
The worker completes the task, proves their work through the evidence-required array, and then a peer reviewer verifies it. As each of these microscopic tasks is completed, the composite confidence of the entire historical record just rises.
Yeah, that bit.
The blurred lines of human history slowly come into crystal clear, undeniable focus.
It creates a self-improving, mathematically verified ecosystem of historical truth. It's quite literally world-building.
Which leaves me with a final thought I want to pose to you as you go about your day. We started by picturing those 85 kilometers of shelves in the Vatican archives.
Yeah, that massive corridor.
For centuries, institutions like that have held a monopoly on historical truth purely through physical possession of the paper and the immense prestige of the historians allowed inside.
That's true.
But if human and AI workflows become seamlessly integrated through this kind of schema, if bad actors and hallucinating bots are mathematically starved out of the system by rigid quality gates, will we eventually reach a future where our trust in historical facts isn't placed in prestigious institutions or famous historians anymore?
That's a deep question.
Right. Will our trust instead be placed entirely in the irrefutable mathematical architecture of the schema itself? Will the cathedral of human history eventually be built not by the authority of kings or popes, but by the sheer, undeniable weight of verified data? Definitely something to chew on.